It is the four-week anniversary of the invasion of Iraq. Today, we're going to spend the rest of the hour listening to MIT professor and leading anti-war critic Noam Chomsky discussing the invasion and its worldwide implications. This speech was recorded in Boulder, Colorado, on April 5th.
Popular opposition also has absolutely no precedent. There was an international Gallup poll. It wasn't reported here. Again, preference for the cocoon last December. The results were pretty interesting. We'll run through them, but just one result, one question asked, had to do with the war that Bush and Blair and Powell and the rest are declaring and are now carrying out, a war that they carry out without any calling themselves the allies, but they're allied only in the sense that they're allied against almost universal world opinion. The coalition forces, as the propaganda system calls them. A war carried out by them didn't even barely reach 10% support in any of the countries polled. The opposition in Europe was greatest in the countries that were where the leadership was lining up with Washington. Over the overwhelming opposition of their own population. That's incidentally being lauded here in a demonstration of hatred and contempt for democracy that also has no precedent. David was making jokes about France, but the reason for why France and Germany are so reviled is that the governments are taking the position of the overwhelming majority of the population. And that's considered a crime. It's a pretty striking fact. The governments that are praised, what Rumsfeld calls the New Europe, they're countries where the leadership is taking their orders from Crawford, Texas, and disregarding, 90% of the population. Those are the good guys. What this tells you about the attitude towards democracy among elites here is pretty astonishing. Don't have to comment on it. I'm sure you noticed that the biggest demonstrations by far in February, mid-February, were in the country. Leadership was going along with the United States, Italy and Spain. Same figures are same right through Eastern Europe. So Hungary, for example, has also about 80 or 90% opposition to the war under any circumstances. The Latin America, of course, overwhelming opposition. There's always overwhelming opposition there to U.S. military intervention, which they've had a little bit of experience with. When the Allies had to have their summit meeting in which they presented an ultimatum to the United Nations, and not to Iraq. They presented an ultimatum to the United Nations, Bush, Blair, Aznar, saying, you follow us in 24 hours or else. Where did they meet? Well, they couldn't meet in any country where there are people around. That's too dangerous. They met in a U.S. military base on an island. That's where you got to meet, like the World Trade Organization, which had to meet in Doha to make sure there's no demonstrations. Be surrounded by navies. That tells you a lot. It's a real achievement. And you really have to ask how, let's say you're this Martian observer, how did Bush and his associates manage to make themselves the most feared and hated political leadership in the world, in fact, maybe ever, shaming the country and ultimately endangering its people? How'd they do it? Well, you look back, you can see how they did it. Just without running through the whole story, just start last September, because there was a big change then. Last September, a lot of important things happened, and they made an effect on world and U.S. opinion. The first and most important was the declaration in late September of the National Security Strategy. Immediately and surprisingly, it was harshly criticized in the main establishment International Affairs Journal, Foreign Affairs, Council on Foreign Relations. which they do it in sort of muted terms, but you could see the concern. It was called an imperial grand vision. The government announced a pretty remarkable doctrine. Basically, what it came down to is that the U.S. is going to rule the world by force. That's the dimension in which it has overwhelming dominance. The U.S. probably outspends the rest of the world combined in military force by now. It's going to rule the world by force, and it's going to do it indefinitely. If the U.S. government perceives any potential challenge to its domination of the world, it's going to destroy it. That's the doctrine that was announced. It's usually in the press, it's called a doctrine of preemptive war. That's not what they announced. A preemptive war has a meaning. It means that if you're under attack, you know, you're under imminent threat of attack, like, back in 1983, the Russians were going to bomb us from an airbase in Grenada. Well, okay, say the Russian planes are in Grenada and they're flying to Florida about to bomb us, then a preemptive war would mean you're allowed to shoot them down before they bomb, and maybe even bomb the threatening airbase in Grenada. That's preemptive war. It has to be an imminent attack that's taking place. That's not what was proposed in September. What was proposed is that they can attack anybody they decide to call a potential threat. And sometimes that's called preventive war, but even that's not fair because they're allowed to invent the threat. It's not preventing anything necessarily. Now, that's the doctrine that was announced. The goal, to quote somebody else, was to use force to prevent any challenge to the power, position, and prestige of the United States. And no legal issue arises if the U.S. acts to prevent any such challenge. That's now the position of the rulers of the country that outspends probably the rest of the world combined in means of violence or close to that. And it's now forging new and very dangerous paths over near unanimous world opposition. Most striking and dangerous of them is the development of lethal weaponry in space, which really does pose a threat to survival of the species. Well, I mentioned I was quoting someone else. It's important who it was. It was Dean Acheson, a respected elder statesman, senior advisor of the Kennedy administration. Quotes what he said in 1963, right after the Cuban Missile Crisis, which almost led to terminal nuclear war. The roots of the missile crisis were a campaign of international terrorism that the Kennedy administration was carrying out in order to carry out what's now called regime change in Cuba. And we know why. Part of the freedom that we've obtained, if we want to use it, is that we have unusual access to internal secret government documents. They get declassified. There's thousands of pages of them on this. We can choose to ignore them if we want, or we can look. And if we look, we find that the reasons for the campaign of international terrorism were that the very existence of the Castro government is a successful challenge to U.S. policies that go back 150 years. What does that mean? Well, it's 150 years of U.S. policy saying you follow our orders or else. And the existence of that regime was successful defiance of that. Furthermore, it was regarded as a threat because of the possible spread of the Castro idea of taking matters into your own hands, which has great appeal to people in the region who suffer from similar forms of oppression. And we got to stop that. 150 years of policy tell us that. Well, that was the reason for the international terrorist campaign, led right to the missile crisis, almost nuclear war, just learned how close it was. After the crisis was over, the terrorist campaign was renewed, along with economic strangulation. And right at that point, Dean Acheson informed the American Society of International Law that no legal issue arises in the case of a U.S. response to a challenge to its power, position, or prestige. Well, that's approximately the Bush Doctrine of September 1992. This is the opposite end of the political spectrum, remember. And that's important to know. We want to understand ourselves, remember what the political spectrum is. Well, why the shudders around the world and the foreign policy elite here in September, last September? Well, there's a reason. Acheson was describing policy, and it's true, that is policy. It's been so for a long time. But the national security strategy last September proclaimed it as official policy, and that's quite a difference, an important one. Actually, you want to think about this, it goes back beyond that. You can find the policy described. There you can find a clear announced discussion of what's now called the Imperial Grand Strategy. So even before the U.S. entered the war, there were study groups of high-level planners from the Council on Foreign Relations, kind of the foreign policy elite, and the State Department, trying to decide what to do in the post-war world. And they concluded that in the post-war world, the United States must hold, I'm quoting it now, must hold unquestioned power and must act to ensure limitation of any exercise of sovereignty by states that interfere with U.S. global designs. That's the September National Security Strategy. And they also recognized that the foremost requirement to secure these ends is rapid fulfillment of a program of complete rearmament. That's a central component of an integrated policy to achieve military and economic supremacy for the United States. That's 1940. At that time, those ambitions were limited to what they called the non-German world. They expected that Germany might win the European war, at least. And the non-German world was going to be organized under the United States rule as what they called a grand area that included the Western Hemisphere, the former British Empire, and the Far East. Well, shortly after that, Russia beat back the Nazi armies at Stalingrad, and it became fairly clear that Germany would ultimately be defeated, and these plans were then extended to include as much of Eurasia as possible, and they were implemented after the Second World War. They've been described since, as in Dean Acheson's comment, and now they're official policy. Well, that's all important to know. In a society that really valued its freedom, I wouldn't have to be saying this. Everybody would have learned it in high school. These are really important things to know about ourselves. There's plenty more like it. The current administration, all of this is kind of reflexive. It's just second nature. Remember that these is almost the same people who ran the country in the Reagan Bush 1 administrations. They had 12 years to do it. It's sort of astonishing when you look at, put yourself in the position of the Martian observer again, and recognize that it's just elementary sanity, if you want to figure out what these guys are up to ask what they did during their first tenure in power. It's 12 years, not ancient history, 1981 to 92. What'd they do? Well, it's interesting that it's almost never investigated. Do a search and see how often people bring up what they did the first time around. Well, if you do it, you'll find that right now they're following almost exactly the same script in detail. The first thing the Reaganites did when they came into office in 1981, first thing they did was drive the country into a deep deficit. Bush administration did exactly the same thing. This time, the way they did it was by a huge tax cut benefiting very tiny top percentage of the population and by the biggest increase in federal spending in 20 years, quoting the Wall Street Journal. But it's a fact, biggest increase in federal spending in 20 years, that goes to the rich, huge tax cut for the rich. Well, that causes a problem, just as it did in the Reagan years. got a deficit, you have to have what's called fiscal responsibility. You know, long, gloomy faces from the economic czars about fiscal responsibility. Fiscal responsibility means you got to cut services for the population. You got to cut benefits that help people. You keep the benefits to the rich. That's what the federal spending and a tax cut are about. Well, during the Reagan years, that's exactly what was done, and it was harmful. Harmful even to economic growth, although there was some, but it was very harmful to the general population. It was 10 years of either stagnation or decline for most people. U.S. Working hours went to the highest in the industrial world. For incomes either stagnated or declined. Working conditions declined. This was called a welcome development of transcendent importance by the Wall Street Journal, which tells you exactly what was going on. Well, it was highly unpopular, as you can imagine. There's a lot of mythology about Reagan's popularity. It's simply untrue. In fact, at the end, by 1992, he was ranked as the most unpopular living ex-president, right next to Richard Nixon, well below Carter and Ford. Well, you know, how'd they stay in power? Pressing the panic button every year, just what they're doing now. So they started right off with, it was recognized right away that Libya is a very convenient punching bag. It's completely defenseless. Everybody hates it. You can do what you want. So they started attacking Libya right away and presenting Libya as a threat. In 1981, Reagan was hiding in the White House because he had to be protected from Libyan hitmen who were wandering around the streets of Washington, and nobody could do anything about them. They were going to kill our leader. Well, somehow he escaped. Libya was trying to expel us from the world. He said nothing less than that. 2 years later came that air base in Grenada, which the Russians were going to use to bomb us. And then there was Nicaragua, 2 days driving time from Harlingen, Texas. Remember that? Really close. And waving copies of Mein Kampf, according to the Secretary of State. A real threat. You know. Reagan called a national emergency in 1985 to defend the country from the threat to the security of the United States posed by the government of Nicaragua. The Martian would be dying of laughter, I guess, but people here didn't laugh. In fact, if you look at that, that was renewed annually right through the 80s. You take a look at it, it's almost the same wording as the congressional resolution in October 2002 about the threat of Saddam Hussein. Imminent threat to the security of the United States. You've got to do something. In the 1980s, it meant a terrorist war against Nicaragua. Ended up with the U.S. had to defy the world court. The Security Council continued, destroyed the country practically. The other countries even worse. In 1988, George Bush was able to get elected, George Bush number one, but only by invoking the threat of black criminal rapists, Willie Horton. You remember that? That's how he got elected, terrified everyone. There were crime frenzies, drug frenzies, just on and on. The international policies then were the same as now. The Reagan administration came into office in 1981, declaring that a war on terror would be the focus of U.S. foreign policy, a war against depraved opponents of civilization itself and a return to barbarism in our time, on and on. And it very quickly turned into a terrorist war. They devastated Central America, the Middle East. It was all over the world. The U.S. supported South Africa right through the 1980s. The Reagan administration had to find ways to get around congressional legislation calling sanctions. They were able to increase trade and support for South Africa right to the end. Just in the Reagan years alone, South African depredations in the surrounding countries, in Angola and Mozambique, killed about 1.5 million people. It's not small. That's when ends up with Colin Powell, the moderate, as national security advisor. In 1988, the U.S. declared Nelson Mandela's African National Congress to be one of the more notorious terrorist organizations in the world. That's part of the reason for supporting the South African apartheid regime. In 1987, December 1987, the U.S. Blocked, voted against, that means essentially vetoed, the strongest U.N. resolution, General Assembly resolution, condemning terror in all its forms. It's the strongest resolution the U.N. has passed. U.S. voted against it. U.S. and Israel alone voted against it. The reason was it had a paragraph in it which said that though they condemn terrorism and have to do everything to stop it, nothing in this resolution prevents the people from struggling against racist and colonialist regimes or foreign military occupation. And the U.S. doesn't accept that. We don't think people have a right to struggle against racist and colonialist regimes and foreign military occupation. Racist and colonialist regimes referred to South Africa. Military occupation referred to Israel. The U.S. alone voted against it, Israel, reflexively. Accordingly, it's not reported, and it's not part of history, except that it is part of history, and it tells you a lot about what's going on. It's December 1987. Well, it continues like that. At that time, they were constrained. There was a deterrent. There's a limit on what you can do. The deterrent's gone. You go on to the national security strategy, uses September 11th as a pretext. The pretext is used by states all over the world. The Russians immediately used it as a pretext for stepping up their really vicious terrorist atrocities in Chechnya, assuming correctly they'd get U.S. endorsement for it. China did the same. Israel did the same in the occupied territories. It's all over. Also, states all over the world, from the Central Asian terrorist dictatorships that Bush backs to the more democratic countries all over the world, it was used as a pretext to discipline their own populations. We know what happened here. The Bush administration has made extraordinary claims, and they've been upheld by the courts to a large extent. They've claimed the right to imprison people, including U.S. citizens, without charge, without access to lawyers or family, and to do so indefinitely until the president declares that an emergency is over, which means executive authority. That's an astonishing claim. George Bush is supposed to have a bust of Winston Churchill on his desk that was given to him by his friend Tony Blair. Churchill had some things to say about this. Might listen to them. He said, "The power of the executive to cast a man into prison without formulating any charge known to the law and to deny him the judgment of his peers is in the highest degree odious and the foundation of all totalitarian government, whether Nazi or communist." That was that's what is being claimed and implemented by the United States. Churchill said this in 1943. Britain was in very serious straits at that time. They were under attack by the most murderous military force in history and came close to being destroyed. That's the moment at which Churchill declared that. And whatever you think about the threats to the United States, then nothing like that. And he's right. It is in the highest degree odious and the foundation of all totalitarian government, whether Nazi or communist, or Washington right now. Those are just plain facts. You know, take a look. And it's getting worse. There's a new Justice Department proposal, which is being called Patriot 2. It was secret, but it was leaked. It was leaked by somebody who didn't like it. And there have been a couple of reports about it in the press. You can actually read it. It's posted on the Internet. NYU law professor Jack Balkin, who wrote about it, says the following. There is no civil right not even the precious right of citizenship that this administration will not abuse to secure ever greater control over American life. And if you read the proposal, he's exactly right. It even grants the Justice Department the right to take away citizenship just by inference, what they call inference, not any actual actions. They somehow infer from something they don't like that they don't like you, they can take away your citizenship. Nothing's ever been claimed like that. That goes far beyond what Churchill described as in the highest degree odious. Well, you know, whether that's implemented or not is up to us. Alan Gilbert here has a recent book which he opens by quoting James Madison, who warned about those who seize upon dangers abroad to blind your eyes to dangers at home. Now, that rings pretty true, worth thinking about. Well, September 11th was the pretext. National Security Council security strategy was announced. Election campaign came along. The doctrine was announced, the doctrine of war against anybody you don't like, preventive war. The purpose is to establish that as a norm of behavior, what international legal scholars will call a new norm in international law. But to establish a norm, you have to do more than declare it. You have to illustrate it. You have to carry it out. You got to show that you're going to do it. Then it becomes a norm if you're a rich and powerful country, not if you're somebody else. Well, how do you do it? You got to pick a target. Target has to meet several conditions. One condition is it has to be defenseless. You got to make sure that you're going to have an overwhelming victory so you can rejoice over the destruction of people from a safe distance. Secondly, it's got to be important. So, like, there's no point going after, you know, Burundi or some place like that. It's got to be a place that matters. Okay, what state satisfies those two conditions? Completely defenseless and very important. Well, that's Iraq. It's been utterly devastated by a decade of sanctions. It's the weakest country in the region, which is why it's not feared, no matter how much it's hated. Even in Kuwait and Iran, which Saddam invaded, not feared. In fact, for the last 5 years, they've been trying to reintegrate it into the regional system over strong U.S. objectives. It's the United States that fears it alone, just like it feared Nicaragua and Grenada and other demons. And it's extremely important. It has the second largest oil reserves in the world. Back as far back as 1945, the State Department described Persian Gulf oil resources as, in their words, a stupendous source of strategic power, one of the greatest material prizes in world history. Ever since then, the U.S. has been determined to control it. It's a leading principle of foreign policy. Actually, it goes back before, but it was the British before. And it's understandable. You don't give away a stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history. It's important to recognize that that means control, not access. The U.S. didn't need the oil. In fact, it barely needs it today. Look at intelligence projections. They're expecting to rely on more secure Atlantic Basin resources, Western Africa, Western Hemisphere. But they want to control it, just as they did after the Second World War. And there's a reason for that. If you control a stupendous source of strategic power, you control the world. That's a lever of world control. You have what planners at the time called veto power over other countries. You can also set prices and production levels within the range that you want, and you can make sure that the profits flow back into the right pockets. It is an enormous to gain control over this resource and to have probably military bases there is a tremendous achievement for world control, if that's what you're aiming at. You read counterarguments to this, and they're worth looking at. So it's argued that the can't be true because the costs of reconstruction are going to be greater than the profits that will be made. Well, you know, maybe that's true, maybe it isn't, but it's totally irrelevant. And the reason is because the costs of reconstruction are going to be paid by the taxpayer, by you. And the profits from the are going to go right into the pockets of the energy corporations. So, yeah, no matter how they balance out, it's just another taxpayer subsidy to the rich. Doesn't matter what the numbers are. So all the discussions are completely irrelevant. The construction, the profits will go to, you know, Bechtel Corporation or Dick Cheney's Halliburton Empire or one thing or another, which will be chosen to what will be called rebuild Iraq at taxpayer expense. That's part of the way in which you transfer wealth and power from the population to the rich, many ways, and that's one. Is there another way to proceed at this point? Yeah, there sure is. The United States could pay reparations to Iraq. That would be proper. And remember what it is. I mean, you know, you're not reading about it in the newspapers, but you all know it's reparations from 20 years of devastation of Iraq. First 10 years of support for Saddam Hussein, right through his worst atrocities. The guy's now in office. Didn't care about the atrocities. Continued to support him, provide him with the means to develop weapons of mass destruction. They even said where they were doing it. It didn't have to do with a war with Iran. Continued after Iran. The reason was because of, as George Bush, number one, explained, his administration, our duty to support American exporters. That's why we had to support Saddam Hussein after the gassing of the Kurds and everything else. And then they added the usual boilerplate about Saddam Hussein being a source of stability and, you know, we can help improve the human rights situation and so on. That went right up to the day of the invasion of Kuwait. First mistake, didn't follow orders. The other crimes were fine. Then comes the war and 10 and a decade of sanctions, which have devastated the population, civilian population, and strengthened Saddam Hussein, and furthermore made the population more dependent on him. I mean, he's a murderous tyrant, but a very efficient one. He had a very efficient food distribution system, which people were dependent on to stay alive. The World Food Organization says the best, the most efficient food distribution system they know of. They say they can't duplicate it even by half. You know, monster, but an efficient monster, not the first one in history. So it forced the population to be dependent on him. It devastated the civilian society, strengthened Saddam Hussein. That's one reason why he's still there. Otherwise, he'd probably have been overthrown by now. Remember that Saddam Hussein was not the only monster who was supported by the guys now in Washington. They had quite an entourage that they collected. They were supporting, among others, Marcos and Duvalier and Suharto and Mobutu, who was the first foreign leader invited to the Bush White House. They loved them so much. Ceausescu, who's easily comparable to Saddam Hussein, vicious, murderous tyrant, supported up until the day he was overthrown by the people now in office. Every single one of those guys was overthrown from within. Why didn't it happen to Saddam, even though they were being supported by the United States, why didn't it happen to Saddam Hussein? Well, you know, the people who, the Westerners who know Iraq best have been talking about this for years. They don't enter, you don't read about them in the American media. You can't find the names in the New York Times index. You can read them in Canada or overseas, England or elsewhere. Namely, the administrators of the UN so-called oil for food programs, Dennis Halliday and Hans von Sponeck. Both of them resigned in protest against what they called the genocidal effect of the program, the sanctions, and the fact that they were destroying the civilian society and strengthening Saddam Hussein. And they've been pointing out for years that the way to overthrow Saddam Hussein is from within, just like every other gangster that was supported by the people now in Washington. Can't happen if you destroy the civilian society and you strengthen the dictator and you make people dependent on him. The main effect of the sanctions hasn't harmed Saddam Hussein and strengthened him, but it's kept him from being overthrown. Otherwise, chances are he would have been gone the way of Ceausescu and the rest of them a long time ago. But an internal revolt is unacceptable to the United States, just as Saddam's leaving Iraq is unacceptable, as they announced at the summit meeting. The reason is very simple. It doesn't leave the United States in charge. It leaves the Iraqi people in charge, and that's no good. At the Azores summit, Bush and Blair announced it explicitly. They said, even if Saddam Hussein goes, we're going to invade anyway, because we have to impose the regime of our choice, not the choice of the Iraqis, whatever that might be. That's critical. Well, it gives you some tasks for people here. One is to ensure the least harmful outcomes, whatever can be done. Another is to try to get to the point where we can provide reparations to Iraqis, and if we can't get to that level of honesty, at least to provide aid that they can use to rebuild the society the way they want to, and not the way somebody in Crawford tells them to. Well, let's go back to last September. Right after it comes October, Congress declares that Saddam Hussein is a threat to our existence, like Nicaragua, and authorizes the government to use force. Something else happened in October, something extremely important. There was a retrospective meeting in Havana, 40th anniversary of the Cuban Missile Crisis. The people who attended were key participants in the October 1962 missile crisis from Russia, the United States, and Cuba. And there was a discovery that actually shattered them there. It turned out that they knew it was a very dangerous moment. Arthur Schlesinger described it as the most dangerous moment in history, which isn't an exaggeration. But they found out last October just how dangerous it was. It turned out that the world was literally one word away from probably terminal nuclear war. It turns out that Russian submarines were under attack by U.S. destroyers. They had nuclear-armed missiles. Two of the commanders assumed that there was a global war going on and called for the missiles to be sent off. If that had happened, there would have been a massive response by the United States, wiped out half of Russia. They would have responded out and wiped out the rest of us, and we wouldn't be here to talk about it. Well, why didn't it happen? One submarine commander countermanded the order. The Russian rules required three commanders to authorize nuclear weapons. Two agreed and one refused. That's why we're here. That's how close it was. This is after a campaign of international terrorism that led to the crisis, aimed at regime change for the kind of reasons I mentioned, all very much in the news last October, very imminent, barely reported. I don't know how many of you know about it. It was barely mentioned. Who cares if the world was one word away from nuclear war after a U.S. campaign of international terrorism? What followed was an increase in the terrorism and Dean Acheson's explanation, which I already read to you. Well, there are more important things than survival, like profits and power. That's what we learn from this. Immediately after this discovery, barely reported, a week later, October 23rd, there was a meeting of the United Nations Disarmament Commission. That's essentially the General Assembly. They passed two extremely important resolutions. One of them reaffirmed a 1925 treaty that bans biological weapons. The second was a resolution that extended a 1967 treaty banning the use of banning the militarization of space, preserving space for peaceful uses. Well, why those weren't reported, those resolutions? I had a friend do a database check. Weren't reported. Why? The United States voted against them alone. The United States and reflexively Israel voted against reaffirming a 1925 ban on biological weapons and a 1967 treaty, now extended, to ban militarization of space. Well, you know, that's really dangerous, both of them, and very urgent. Shortly after, but not reported, right after that, the U.S., the Bush administration, killed a bioweapons treaty that was under negotiation, stunning the Europeans. Last minute, the U.S. stepped in and says, no, we're not going to allow any discussion of enforcement mechanisms for years. The reason, got to protect the secrets of U.S. pharmaceutical corporations. It's much more important than banning biological weapons. Probably there's another reason. It's very likely that the United States is carrying out illegal tests of development of biological weapons. A lot of scientists guess that that's the reason why they haven't been able, they claim that they haven't been able to find the source of the anthrax attack. It was traced back to a U.S. federal laboratory, remember. This is not like disarming Iraq. It's a U.S. federal laboratory. They claim not to be able to find the source. It's kind of hard to believe. But it may be, and it's been speculated by the Federation of American Scientists and others, that probable reason is that they're concealing some kind of weapons development program that they want exposed. Well, maybe not. We've got to find out about it. Right after that, the U.S. went on to infuriate even its closest allies in the World Trade Organization, first of all by taking a very extreme stand violating trade rules. Notice that that's another reiteration. It's still following the script of the Reagan years. A lot of talk about free trade, but they were the strongest opponents of free trade in the industrial world. In fact, the Reagan administration was the most protectionist government in post-war U.S. history. They virtually doubled the protectionist barriers in the United States. The GATT, which is the predecessor of the World Trade Organization, according to their analysis, Reaganite protectionist measures were three times as high as other industrial countries, very damaging to world trade, but you know, most powerful state in the world does what it wants, and they're doing it right again. The Bush administration has broken some new barriers and protectionist measures, but much worse than that, and this really did amaze and infuriate Europe and others, is just a couple of weeks ago, the U.S. intervened to prevent efforts which had been agreed to by the other industrial powers, efforts to provide inexpensive drugs to people who are dying of treatable diseases, AIDS, malaria, tuberculosis, and others. That's tens of millions of people who are dying from these diseases, and the U.S. intervened to prevent access to inexpensive drugs, again, because huge profits for heavily subsidized U.S. pharmaceutical corporations are a much higher priority. Well, you know, it doesn't make you popular. The U.S. also continued to is continuing to undermine international efforts to reduce threats to the environment, which are by now universally recognized to be severe and maybe a threat to survival. The pretext for this barely conceal service to pretty narrow sectors of private power. If you take a look at the journal Science, the journal of the American Association for Advancement of Science, the lead editorial about a week ago was a bitter condemnation of the Bush administration, the climate change science plan, which does absolutely nothing. It doesn't even does nothing to stop what just about every scientist who pays attention recognizes to be a very severe threat. Well, again, profits are more important. All of this engenders fear and hatred of the leadership. And maybe, ultimately, hatred of the society, which was regarded as just too dangerous. That's going to lead to efforts at deterrence. How do you deter a country which has overwhelming military power? Well, you know, every international affairs specialist can tell you, and does tell you, by proliferation of weapons of mass destruction and proliferation of terror. That's what the Bush administration is going to achieve, as I say. Osama bin Laden must be cheering somewhere. Well, go back to that intelligent Martian. If he has some concern for the human species, he might be watching all of this with some amazement and asking how long it can be that people who live in a free country are going to allow it to go on. Thanks.
That was Professor Noam Chomsky speaking in Boulder, Colorado, at an event sponsored by KGNU Radio.